bottom line is we've got a new set of faces with a new look and maybe some new ideas, and I'm ready to listen to those ideas.
The state Senate reorganizes after big Republican election wins. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, November 7th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a longtime state lawmaker may have been ousted in a southeast race that's too close to call.
Disappointed for the district because as co-chair of finance, people just don't realize what stroke that has. They'll find out.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Last night's election has shifted the balance of power in the state Senate toward the Republican Party. At least six members of the bipartisan working group will not be returning to the legislature in January. Members of the Senate have been meeting today to discuss its leadership and have just announced the plan for reorganization at a news conference on the west side of Anchorage. Alexandra Gutierrez was there and joins us now. Hi, Alexandra.
Good evening, Lori.
What is the new leadership structure?
Well, two of the people who had been in the previous Senate minority, which was just four Republicans, are now in the two most powerful positions in the Senate. Charlie Huggins is now the Senate president, and John Coghill is now the majority leader. We also have Pete Kelly and Kevin Meyer taking over the finance positions, and Lisa McGuire is now the chair of the Rules Committee.
What does this mean for the Senate bipartisan coalition?
Well, it's effectively done. There were no Democrats in attendance today. There were 10 Republicans there with another one out of town, so they've got 11 Republicans. They say that they're willing to accept new members, so the group could be bipartisan in name, but it will be dominated by Republicans. Interestingly, the current Senate President Gary Stevens and Finance Co-Chair Bert Stedman were not in attendance at the meeting. However, Senator Charlie Huggins said that he would consider them as members if they showed interest in joining. And it looks like there should be more meetings as we get closer to the legislative session where the coalition could, well, what used to be the coalition could grow into a new coalition, even though it will be substantially different from the previous one.
Alexandra, does the new Senate structure maintain any of the elements of the coalition?
So far, it doesn't appear that that's the case. The first thing that Senator Huggins said, as far as priorities were concerned, was that he was looking at changing the oil tax regime right now. For the past two legislative sessions, there's been kind of a stalemate concerning oil tax reform, with the governor and the House majority being in favor of oil tax cuts, and then the Senate bipartisan working group saying, hey, we need more commitments from oil companies that they're actually going to increase production. When asked if this group would require some sort of, you know, hard deal from the oil companies to increase production, they said that they hadn't really gotten that far. This is all very preliminary, and that it's been less than 24 hours since these elections, and more details will become clear as the legislature convenes.
What does this mean, do you think, for Governor Parnell's push for lowering oil taxes?
I think that he is probably very happy today. Right now, this group looks like it's really receptive to working with him, and it looks like they are more likely to be on board with his plan than the previous Senate majority group. No hard commitments were made today as far as what they were going to do because just preliminary organizational sessions, it sounds like there's a good chance that this won't be like the previous two legislative sessions where we went into special session to discuss oil tax reform and then nothing came of it.
All right. Thanks, Alexandra, for that update for us.
You're welcome, Lori.
That was reporter Alexandra Gutierrez, who has been following the Senate leadership talks today. The most expensive Alaska Senate race was also the closest last night. Incumbent Democratic Senator Hollis French eked out a win for a newly drawn district that includes Sand Lake and West Anchorage. With 100% of precincts reporting, French has about 51% of the vote, compared with 49% for his challenger, Anchorage businessman Bob Bell. They are separated by 247 votes, and there are still more than 1,500 absentee ballots to count. Bell says it was a wild ride last night, and he isn't optimistic about his chances to win the race, but he isn't conceding yet.
If there's 2,000 absentee ballots, in order to overcome a 250-vote deficit, I would have to get about 63% of the absentee ballots. And that's a pretty high bar on an election that was almost 50-50. It's a long shot, but we'll wait and see what happens.
French is optimistic his win will hold. The Division of Elections will begin counting absentee ballots in the race on November 13th. House District 34 in Southeast Alaska is also still too close to call. Only 44 votes separate Republican State Representative Bill Thomas from Democratic challenger Jonathan Kreiss Tompkins, who is 23 years old. KCAW's Ed Ronco has more.
44 is about the number of people it would take to fill every seat on a school bus. It is less than the number of players allowed on an NFL team. And in a legislative election, a 44-vote difference isn't enough to know anything.
We've been looking at the data and you know, probably 800 absentee ballots are yet to be counted, although I've heard all sorts of different numbers.
That is Jonathan Kreiss Tompkins speaking to KCAW just before 11 o'clock on election night.
It's going to make a big impact. We put a real concerted effort into banking ballots early. I mean, my vote has not yet been counted. It's an early vote, and ditto for probably a majority of the people who are at our little election night party here at Worldwide Headquarters.
The next morning, Bill Thomas was having breakfast at the Bamboo Room in Haines with members of his staff. He told radio station KHNS that even if he wins the election, he's already lost some power in Juneau.
The chairmanship of the finance is gone. There's people ready up there picking my bones, so they all want it, so they're not going to wait for me. So I'll probably end up sitting in some committee starting all over again, you know. But and I won't have the stroke to get any big amounts of money for any big projects.
Thomas and Kreiss Tompkins both ran intense campaigns, especially in the last couple weeks. Now, both candidates find themselves waiting for absentee ballots to be counted. That has to happen within 15 days of the election. A recount is also a possibility. Tight races are not new to Thomas. When he first won his seat in 2004, results were so close that there was a recount. It left him with a 59-vote victory over Democrat Tim June, also of Haines.
And I won't be disappointed if I'm out. I can go back fishing, but I'm disappointed for the staff. I got six staff. Disappointed for the district because as co-chair of finance, people just don't realize what stroke that has. They'll find out.
House District 34 includes Sitka, Haines, Clockwan, Hoonah, Cake, Angoon, Port Alexander, Pelican, and Elfin Cove. With reporting from Margaret Friedenauer at KHNS in Haines, this is Ed Ronco in Sitka.
In other election results, voters are sending Republican Congressman Don Young back to Washington. The $453 million bond proposition passed by a wide margin last night, but voters did not approve a measure that would have required a new constitutional convention. That question is put in front of voters every 10 years. And voters retained all 26 judges on the ballot, including Sen Tan. He was the target of a campaign by Alaska Family Action, who wanted to oust him for two abortion-related decisions in the late 1990s. Two interior members of Alaska bipartisan Senate coalition fell to Republicans yesterday. Incumbent Senators Joe Pascavan and Joe Thomas were defeated by Senator John Coghill and former legislator Pete Kelly. KUAC's Emily Schwing reports.
Republican Senator John Coghill defeated incumbent Democrat Joe Thomas in what he calls a difficult race. Tuesday night's results mean big changes for Alaska's Senate bipartisan coalition. Coghill says it's no secret he didn't support that coalition.
Now, I've worked in coalitions down through the years. I just like him to be as conservative as I can possibly get him and at a place where I can play with some degree of authority.
Interior candidates focused mainly on the cost of energy this year. The issue of oil tax reform also played a strong role in campaigns. Former legislator and Republican Pete Kelly defeated incumbent Democrat Joe Pasquin in a tight race. Kelly is reportedly completing a mission trip in Asia, so he was unavailable for comment. Republican Glick Bishop will also join Senator Coghill and Pete Kelly in Juneau next year. He defeated Democrat Ann Sudkamp by a wide margin. He says regardless of his political affiliation, he'll make decisions for the good of the interior.
If it meant joining a coalition and that was good for Fairbanks and good for the district, I would do that.
Newly elected senators will head for Anchorage later this week to hammer out the details and to start planning for the next 2 years. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
Republicans also won 4 of 6 races for House districts lying within the interior, with North Pole Mayor Doug Isaacson presiding over the most lopsided win. Incumbent Republican Eric Feige also cruised to victory in District 6 with just over 72% of the vote over Jamie Duhamel. Republicans Tammy Wilson and Pete Higgins also won elections in District 2 and 7. Many interior candidates downplayed partisanship and preached the gospel of cooperation. One exception was District 4 winner Democrat Scott Kawasaki's recounting of the bitter and expensive political battle between him and challenger David Pruse.
He outraised us by 2-1. He outspent us by 2-1. The Republican Party poured a bunch of money in this campaign against me, and basically they went negative the entire time.
In District 38's race, Democrat David Guttenberg handily beat Republican Alan Dick by about 16 percentage points. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a national scam targets small rural business.
And it seemed very suspicious, but I gave him my email because I wanted to see what this was all about.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Housing Finance Corporation offers home choice seminars that provide tools for making informed decisions about purchasing and financing a home and loans tailored for first-time home buyers. There's more information at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
The state of Alaska announced winners of oil and gas rights in a lease sale held in Anchorage today. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, the state took in more than $14 million.
The sum was a couple of million dollars lower than the previous lease sale, but it was an amount that happily surprised Bill Barron. Barron is director of the Division of Oil and Gas at the state DNR. Companies purchased the rights on tracts of land in and along the Beaufort Sea, on the North Slope, and in the North Slope foothills. Barron says the locations of the purchases could show new areas for development.
You could see that a lot of companies were gathering acreage around land that they purchased over the last several sales. You could see some filling in gaps by some of the competitors of some folks. You can see a direct correlation that there looks like a western development area that has apparently some promise by the industry.
At least 3 companies bought land in the western area Barron mentions, sandwiched between Kuparuk and the National Petroleum Reserve. Barron says he's excited to see new individuals and small operations make bids, but perhaps he's more excited to see the return of BP and Conoco.
Any activity, especially from some of the major players and some of the minor players, is good for the state. So yeah, I was really excited when I opened up the bids and saw some of the primary players that have been there historically actually now stepping back in on new acreage.
Barron says it's been a while since producers have looked at the foothills region. He attributes the renewed interest to possible gas reserves in the area. The permits last 10 years and do not require a company to begin work. In Anchorage, I'm Peter Granitz.
The Department of Interior conducted its own lease sale today as well. The Bureau of Land Management accepted 14 bids in the NPRA. The 160,000 acres bid on today is just a fraction of the 4.5 million that were available. The Bureau of Land Management's Ruth McCord says two companies bought the oil drilling rights.
Woodstone Resources had two bids, and theirs were in the northeast planning area. NORDAC had 12 bids that were in the northwest planning area.
NORDAC also won several bids at the day's earlier lease sale sponsored by the state. McCord says the rights went for $898,000, with half going to the federal government and half to the state. There's another company looking at producing liquefied natural gas on the North Slope. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the move could broaden Fairbanks' access to the cheaper, cleaner-burning fuel.
Tulsa, Oklahoma-based Spectrum LNG is seeking permits for a short-connecting pipeline to carry natural gas from Prudhoe Bay and a plant to process it. Spectrum President Ray Latcham says his company's plan is pretty basic.
Build, own, and operate an LNG plant in Prudhoe Bay, and it will provide fuel to things like mines and drilling rigs, heavy trucks, transit vehicles. Once the LNG is in a tanker truck, it can go to any number of locations. It can go to Golden Valley, would be a potential customer as well.
Latcham estimates Spectrum will spend about $30 million to build the North Slope LNG facilities. He says initial output will be small, about 100,000 gallons per day, but the facility will be set up to allow for fourfold expansion. Latcham has Alaska connections. He started Norgasco, a gas utility serving Prudhoe Bay and Deadhorse, and Fairbanks Natural Gas, which trucks in LNG from Cook Inlet. Latcham says Spectrum does not currently have a gas supply contract or any commitments from buyers.
What we have is a good idea and some money we want to invest in a plant. And we didn't have any offtake agreements when we built the one in Point McKenzie that Fairbanks Natural Gas uses today.
Latcham sold the Cook Inlet processing facility and his interest in Fairbanks Natural Gas in 2004. His new company's North Slope LNG project competes with a larger one being pursued by FNG. FNG President Dan Britton says there may not be room in the market for more than one North Slope LNG plant, but until someone spends money and starts building, nothing changes.
They may or may not, and, you know, in the event they do build something, then you know, perhaps we would compete for the LNG sales to other areas.
FNG already has the permits it needs to move ahead, as well as a gas supply contract. The barrier has been the $150 million price tag for its LNG processing plant. Spectrum wants to begin work on its much smaller LNG project next year. Britton says if Spectrum moves ahead faster, FNG could refocus on just transporting gas to Fairbanks.
If somebody could provide us a LNG at a good price, and you know, we'd always look at that.
North Star Borough Mayor Luke Hopkins says another company looking at North Slope LNG presents a potential option for Fairbanks.
The issue is that, how fast can gas in larger, much larger volumes serve Fairbanks, and at what cost? Because if, you know, consumers aren't necessarily going to jump to that if it's high-priced energy.
The borough recently created a municipal gas utility to facilitate getting North Slope LNG to Fairbanks. That could include securing tax-free state grants or low-interest loans, money that could be passed on to private companies to advance a project. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Condor Airlines, offering nonstop service to Frankfurt from Anchorage and Fairbanks between May and September, with connections to most German and European destinations. Details available at condor.com. First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
Bethel may be 400 miles off the road system, but it's no stranger to fraud. Most recently, office supply scams. KYUK's Angela Denning Barnes has more.
If you get a call about a super deal for your company's Xerox machine, don't assume it's for real. There are Xerox scams.
I received a phone call from a guy named Jack Miller.
That's Anna Hoffman, president of Bethel Native Corporation.
He said he was with Xerox, and he asked me if I was a purchasing agent for the company. And he said that the price of the toner had gone up, but he was going to honor the former price, and a guy from Xerox Capital Support Services was going to call me to give me the invoice information.
And that's exactly what happened. About 20 minutes later, Hoffman receives another call from another person.
And this person gets on the phone and he says, "Did Jack Miller speak to you?" And I said, "Yes." And he says, "Okay, I have this invoice for you for the toner for your Xerox copier. Can I get your email address?" And it seemed very suspicious, but I gave him my email because I wanted to see what this was all about.
Hoffman receives an invoice, and by all accounts, it looks pretty legitimate. Still, Hoffman does a little research to try to find out who this company really is. She couldn't find them anywhere online, so she decides to call BNC's Xerox representative in Anchorage.
And she said that this was a scam.
In fact, Hoffman learned that villages in the YK Delta had been hit by a similar scam. Some offices paid the money and others didn't. The Anchorage Xerox company didn't return calls to KYUK. But if you Google Xerox scams, you'll find that they are a national fraud. Xerox.com actually has a name for them, toner phoners. The Alaska Department of Law deals with consumer fraud. Cindy Drinkwater is the assistant attorney general. She says office supply scams have been around for a long time.
It's important for businesses, especially small businesses and nonprofit agencies, to understand that they are the targets of this kind of scam. And it would be a really good idea to talk about how to deal with this and to have procedures in place so that there's maybe one person who has the authorization to make office supply purchases and that they use a purchase order procedure.
Drinkwater says sometimes the scammers can be aggressive, going after payments, but consumers should not give in.
They also should not pay. Even though they might get a lot of pressure to pay, the scammers might say that they're going to send them to collections or take them to court. But if the item was not properly authorized for purchase, they shouldn't pay and to file a complaint and not fall prey to possible bullying by the scammers.
You can find a lot of information about scams and fraud at the Department of Law's website, www.law.state.ak.us. You can also file fraud complaints there. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning-Barnes.
Moose calf mortality is a big concern among state wildlife managers. Alaska Fish and Game has data indicating that 83% of collared moose calves died in one Kenai game unit alone. But moose researcher Vic Van Ballenberg, who has spent more than 3 decades studying moose in the Denali Park area, has his own theory of how a strong calf can be the result of choices a cow moose makes long before that calf is conceived. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Vic Van Ballenberg, who has worked for both the Alaska Department of Fish and Game and the U.S. Forest Service, is a biologist well known for his work with moose in Alaska. He's now retired, but does consulting for conservation groups and for film organizations. He just returned from 6 weeks in Denali National Park, where he's studied moose for more than 3 decades. And one aspect of his research is looking at why some cows are better at raising calves than others.
You know, we've been able to follow some cows during their entire reproductive lifetime, and we found that during that lifetime, some cows only raise 1 to 2 calves, while others raise 10 or more.
He's been trying to find out why there is such a wide variation. Diet plays a role, of course. Some moose are more efficient at processing food. And when food is scarce, some cows don't get pregnant. Van Ballenberg says maybe some cows are better at avoiding predators or producing better milk or finding better feeding areas.
The differences among cows are only part of the story. Maybe some calves are better able to survive than others. And calves get half of their genes from their fathers, and so it's important to understand something about the bulls that father these calves. And if it's the case that some bulls are more fit than others and cows can detect that, maybe the cows are actually selecting which bulls to mate with.
He says his recent research in Denali supports this idea.
And so the first thing that we found is that the mature bulls actually do most of the mating. And they do that by excluding the younger bulls through either chasing them away from cows or actually fighting. The matures do most of the actual mating, and they do it by controlling groups of cows.
He says in the fall, cows get together in groups of 5 or 6 or as many as 20. Most cows remain within the group, and by choosing groups, they choose which bulls to mate with. Van Ballenberg says mate choice among mammals is a recent focus of researchers. Some mammals mate at random. Others mate through some degree of choice. In the case of moose, mating is not a direct choice, since when the cow joins a group, it's not certain which bull will dominate. But this brings up the question of killing off mature bulls through hunting, something that concerns biologists. Van Ballenberg says he is not a wildlife manager, but his research could be useful to them. The new information could become a valuable tool to rebuild moose populations depleted by severe winters. Hunting and predator control are manipulations of the moose population by humans, and there is a possibility that too much predator control could ultimately weaken the moose population by allowing the weaker bull moose to survive, according to Van Ballenberg.
Wolf and bear predation on moose over millennia has shaped moose in terms of almost every characteristic that they have. You know, that predation pressure through evolution has created moose that are big and strong and agile and alert, and they have extremely good senses of smell and hearing and sight. All of those things are the net result of heavy predation by bears and wolves on moose.
Van Ballenberg says removing predation pressure could allow less able moose to survive, and that would have an impact on the moose population over the long term. Tony Hollis, a moose biologist with Alaska Fish and Game in Fairbanks, says management targets a 30-to-100 ratio of bulls to cows. Hollis says it's true that cows prefer larger bulls with a greater antler spread. Hunting regulations restricting antler size ensure that some mature bulls survive to mate, Hollis says, although it is also true that a cow moose will select a mate with smaller antlers if that is what is available. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Alexander Gutierrez and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Ed Ronco in Sitka, Emily Schwing, Tim Ellis, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. ConocoPhillips, the easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Era Alaska. For more than 30 years, Era Alaska has been transporting packages across the state, business documents, medical supplies, even family pets. More details at flyera.com or talk to your local Era Alaska agent. Era Alaska, bringing Alaskans together.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation now offers financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.